We do this work with and for the families of our missing and murdered relatives who are gone but never forgotten.
They try to conquer and divide us. We keep on fighting what we hate.
We burn it down. Now what do we create?
We want freedom,
liberation of our minds. Let our love for the people be our guide.
The rate of violent crime committed against Native Americans is higher than the national average.
Indigenous women and girls and people are disproportionately affected by domestic violence, human trafficking, and murder.
Studies going back to 2016 by the National Institute of Justice, NIJ, found that more than 4 in 5 American Indian and Alaska Native women have experienced violence within their lifetime. That is 84.3%.
Now, these are all very frightening statistics. The focus of this podcast is MMIP, Missing or Murdered Indigenous People. According to recent research by the Yurok tribe, Indigenous people are far less safe in California than in most of the other colonized states in the U.S.
And California has the 5th highest amount of MMIP cases of all 50 colonized states. The vast majority are young women and girls.
A disproportionate number of the murders are unsolved.
And these families deserve justice.
On this podcast, we hold space for friends and family to talk about their journey and any quest they may have for justice. Our vision is to share the stories of their loved one with as much honor and respect as possible and bring as much attention to the cases as we can. The first 6 episodes of the podcast focus on California, but the conversations hold significance for Indigenous communities worldwide.
Our state ranks 5th of all the states in the nation of not bringing resolve or investigating missing and murders against Native American women, Native American persons.
Today, there are at least 20 MMIP cases recorded every year in Northern California, but the actual number is significantly higher since there are serious issues with the accuracy of the data involving missing and or murdered Indigenous people.
Together, we hold vigil, we sing, we dance, and we pray for justice, for safety, and for change.
You're listening to MMIP Justice. We are your hosts. I'm Sarah Blanco.
I am Lauren Redhawk-Colley.
Stay tuned.
We keep on fighting what we hate.
We burn it down. Now what do we create?
We want freedom,
liberation of our minds. Let our love for the people be our guide.
Welcome to the MMIP Justice Podcast, Episode 1. Violence against Native men is more common than it is in other demographic groups of men, and LGBTQ and Two-Spirit people in tribal communities are also often targets of violence.
For our first episode, we give space for the loved ones of Yogi McGarva. You will hear his younger brother, and you are going to hear his sister's words, plus his friends and fellow tribal members will remember him as well.
Yogi was murdered on his ancestral lands. We follow the developments of the murder trial, and we talk with his family about their 4-year-long fight for justice. Even with what is known about MMIP, there are significant gaps in the data. Indigenous people are not statistics. We only bring the statistics to you because knowing where the gaps are is one way to prevent these terrible crimes. There are many First Peoples who are researching how best to protect themselves. When we hear other stories, as painful as they are, we attempt to pay honor to their loved one. And we can also see the things that they've suffered through, where the cracks are in the systems and institutions that claim to protect society. Yogi's life was taken by another person on March 9, 2020, in a place named Likely in Modoc County, California. I first learned of his tragic passing that spring of 2020. I saw posts on Facebook, Justice for Yogi, and I remember that I wasn't going out too much at all as the emergence of the pandemic was starting to grip the world. So as the months passed, I was getting further and further from interacting at public events, even for important social justice causes. I didn't know that 4 years later, I would be writing about justice for Yogi. So by February 2024, I saw a call out for people to support Yogi's family by attending the murder trial. It appeared to be a landmark case for many reasons. First, the fact that there was a trial at all was significant. Given that the defendant, a non-Native man, was being tried for the killing of a Native man in that county. And there's the fact that this is already in a remote part of California, known for its history of massacres of indigenous peoples, and they have tombstones of the soldiers and colonizers dotting the landscapes. And the fact that there was a murder trial at all was quite the feat, seeing as multiple district attorneys offered the defendant a lesser plea deal, and the family we spoke to didn't agree with that. So on February 19th, 2024, upon invitation from a friend of the family, our production crew traveled to Alturas in northeasternmost part of California. This is where the Superior Courthouse is for Modoc County. We traveled there to attend a murder trial. A man by the name of Jarrett Blue Rucker was said to have killed Yogi in the home they both lived in, March 9th, 2020. Before we left, I noted there were two main articles written about the case in that local area. The first, where they described that two men were found, one deceased and one with injuries that was still alive. Then there was a second article that Jarrett Blue Rucker, the man who survived, was arrested on suspicion of murder. Then it seemed to be mainstream news silence. And it only later, during the trial, becomes clear just how many injuries there were on Yogi and how bloody Yogi's home was when Modoc sheriffs first arrived. But this is not only a story of a brutal crime against a Native man by a non-Native. This is a story of Yogi's steadfast family and unflinching friends who continue to grapple with the pain of loss and the arduous journey from what they see as the bare minimum of justice for the crime that stole their beloved Yogi away from them. When you love someone, family or friend, whether you've known them a long time or not, it matters how others speak about them in life and when they're gone from this life. I'm thinking about this as we travel up to Modoc County. The skies are clear, the ground was clear from snow in most places, and you start to get increasingly isolated up there. It's like the car gets smaller and the trees get bigger. Then the vastness of a valley opens up, but still we see snow-topped mountain peaks in the distance. And an endless rainbow marked the entrance to the county for a large part of the way up there. There's vast expanses of lowlands, there's hills, tiny towns with some small homes or enormous farms, but they were all still few and far between as we drove. And the Pitt River following alongside of us. The snowflakes only gently came in as we neared our destination. When we arrived at our hotel, the first thing I saw were signs of two missing young adult men, both appearing to be white. I wondered, was there anybody else missing in the area? We know there must be, but that wall didn't say so. I do hope those men and all the missing in that area are found safe. Early the next morning, on Tuesday, February 20th, 2024, we joined Yogi's family and friends on a march, walking in the morning cold from the Strong Family Center, not to the courtroom, but to the Pitt River Tribal Center, where we were going to watch the jury selection virtually. During that march, I saw that family and friends and other supporters were holding signs and pictures of Yogi, with his niece, Aurelia, out in front, holding a very tall banner of Yogi's adorable face. It was a photo I'd recognized from social media. On that short walk, I asked someone on the march if they wanted to share a few words about why they were marching today.
I'm marching as a person who knows the family. And believes that there needs to be justice. And I want to support that.
As the marchers arrived at the Pitt River Tribal Health Center, we all filed into a very small room. I was surprised we were watching the jury selection virtually. I didn't ask questions. I was just grateful to be a part of it. And again, to be clear, we were invited by someone who was close with the family, or we would not have been in their space. That's when I met Yogi's family for the first time. Myself and others sat glued to our chairs to watch the jury selection. A Modoc County victims advocate with the DA's office was there, and she made sure no one was recording anything. As we watched, we heard the judge note that while a very large number of people were summoned for jury duty, only a very small number actually showed up. And while we couldn't tell if anyone on the jury is Native, we didn't think that that was going to be likely. I noted that the defendant, Jarrett, was in a suit, fresh haircut, and we knew he'd been in jail for almost 4 years, but we didn't know if the jury knew that. When I later asked an associate familiar with the justice system and reentry, he told me that maybe it was so the jury didn't think that Jarrett was already in custody, so they didn't see him in handcuffs. Okay, I thought. But I wondered, across cities and counties and courtrooms and bailiffs, who gets to choose which defendants are shackled and which are not? Well, day one, jury selection. This day was exhausting for everyone. They pretty much picked the jury today, and we all went our separate ways. The next day, Wednesday, the first day of the murder trial, was held at the Barclay courtroom. Very small space, and we attended in person, as did the family and other community members, as well as there were people who had traveled 6 to 10 hours to be there in support of the family. While a lot was said, and a lot was described, and multiple people testified, I'm only going to outline some of the basics. Jarrett Blue Rucker, also goes by Blue, was being charged with murder in the first degree, plus separate felony crime of injuring a spouse or cohabitant. They did live together, and they were partners. But somewhere across the murder trial, they decided not to charge him with that separate felony of injuring a cohabitant. However, there was also a special allegation of using a deadly and dangerous weapon. We also learned the Attorney General was not pursuing the death penalty. And though the defendant, Blue, pled not guilty, his lawyer said that Jarrett didn't deny killing Yogi, but that the defense would give an explanation. Yogi's sister, Jerry, testified as well, mainly that Yogi was a great person, but also that Yogi was just unable to defend himself because of his health and his inability to stand for too long. Yogi's sister explained that the defendant did live with Yogi for the last couple of years, and she said that Yogi was hard to provoke to anger. Some of the first responding testimony includes the undersheriff at that time. He said he responded to a call of a stabbing or multiple stabbings, and when he arrived, 2 CHP were outside the residence, and that a voice inside said for him to go to the smaller door, but it was locked, so the undersheriff broke a window pane, then unlocked the door. Warning, the following descriptions can be triggering and has aspects of brutal violence in it. We won't describe everything out of respect for the family. Once inside, they found Yogi not responsive on the ground, with clear evidence of multiple injuries and large amounts of blood. And the other man, Blue, was also there but alive and complaining of pain. Blue was treated by EMS and transported for further medical care. Additional law enforcement responded to that crime scene, including current local sheriff Tex Dowdy. Now, I'm going to describe a portion of a jailhouse informant testimony. Although this was a calm scene, it still was all quite dramatic. He'd apparently, sometime prior to the trial, had contacted local Modoc County investigators, saying he had information about the Yogi McGarva case specifically, and information that the defendant, Jarrett, had told him while they were cellmates. And these were details about the crime itself, including that Jarrett had snuck up behind Yogi and hit him with a golf club, and then used a knife to slice his throat, and that Jarrett planned the attack on Yogi for 3 days ahead of time. I noticed that the informant entered shackled and in an orange jumpsuit. When the informant got on the stand, the prosecutor tried to draw out his testimony based on all the things he had said previously when he'd met with investigators. But his story turned to silence, and he would just say, "I don't remember." And it seemed to me that he was looking over in the defendant's direction with a very unflinching and serious look on his face, and he just kept answering that he didn't remember. Then, despite asking if he could leave the courtroom, the judge let him know he did have to stay and testify. So the prosecutor pivots and asks him if he'd been injured recently in jail. And this, the informant admits and describes being hit out of nowhere, and actually says that he got his head split open. And he says that he hadn't seen who had done it. Lawyers for both sides are very clear to say there was no evidence that Jarrett Blue Rucker had done that. The judge was going to later reference how she felt the defendant and the informant appeared to be exchanging continuous looks across the room. So it wasn't just me thinking that. The judge also stated that the informant was going to be transferred to a prison institution where informants are not looked upon kindly, and that she personally didn't believe the informant had suddenly lost their memory and was allowing his prior statements about what he says Jarrett told him about the crime. Of course, it would be up to the jury to decide what, if anything, to do with the jailhouse informant's testimony and what to consider about any records they might have access to that he had said previously. It was up to them what to believe. The defense attorney tried to cast doubt on his credibility because the informant has claimed at times that he's omnipotent or essentially a god. The defense attorney did also suggest that if the crime had been premeditated, it would have looked a lot different. The insinuations there were enough to make my skin crawl. So after this first day, we could see that the defendant was not going to be handcuffed or shackled, not even when exiting the courtroom, and when he walked down the stairs on his own, while a group of us stood outside talking, a bailiff was a few feet behind him, and then they walked down the trail that we believe leads to the local jail next door. And in the courtroom, the defendant sat very close to the benches where we were, maybe 4 feet away from the first pews, about 7 feet from a jury member, and then a leap of about 20 feet from his chair to the witness stand or to the judge, and then maybe even less than that to get out the doors and outside of the main building. At that point, no one knew if Jarrett would testify either, and of course no one knows what the jury is thinking. All you can seem to do is take it 1 hour at a time. Although it is the superior court of the area, the system and the spaces are too small to have consecutive days even for a murder trial. So the judge put the trial on hold for that Thursday. This plus other times where there were extended long breaks were frustrating for the family. I can only imagine it just extends the amount of time that they have to wait, and that waiting may mean they can't put it behind them yet. During dinner that evening, co-producer Frank Sterling and I met with Yogi's family and friends at a local pizza place, and they have Italian food. We joked about we were just there for lunch earlier in the day, and we really had been. I mean, it's such a small town, and it really was excellent food, but anywhere that we ate in town was actually pretty good. The family's friend, Morningstar Galley, and founder of the organization Indigenous Justice, was also there. We took a moment to ask her about the case, and she tells us that this is an important case for Native people. Plus, Yogi's brother Russell and sister Jerry tell us more about Yogi.
This case is important in Pitt River territory known as Issawi, as Yogi McGarva was a tribal council member. He ran on the Modoc Ancestral Run with us. He was very involved culturally. Being a two-spirit individual here within Modoc County, within rural northeastern California, was really difficult and really challenging in terms of a lot of discrimination and a lot of bigotry that still very much exists today. And so the fact that there has actually been charges put forward in terms of a non-Native individual against a tribal member is something that's unheard of out here and something that's really significant in our seek for justice for the families and for all cases of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples, where these cases, the majority of them never actually make it to this point that go to trial.
We also caught up with the family. We spoke to Yogi's little brother, Russell McGarva, and his sister, Jerry.
He fought the last 3 years before that so hard to stay alive. He had 13 different surgeries, and I mean, he made it through it, you know, and to be taken the way he was from us, it's just not right.
Fun-loving guy that made everybody laugh when he was around. We all laughed and joked and kidded with each other. He helped everybody out. We cooked for people's funerals.
The McGarvas invited us to their home to do an interview with Yogi's siblings, Jerry and Russell. Since the murder trial was on hold until Friday, our production crew drove out to their home that Thursday, which is about 20 minutes away from our motel. Despite the late February chill lingering in the air, the day was clear, sharp, and bright, with distant snow-topped mountains adding to the scenery and adding to the mood. It was really beautiful out when we got to the McGarvas' home. Two of Jerry's young adult children, Aurelia and Greeley, greeted us with such warmth and large smiles. I joked that I thought they'd all still be sleeping, but nope. They said they'd already been working out in the backyard that morning. As I looked out toward the back of the home, I could see a row of trees that had lost all their leaves for the winter, and I could tell that water flowed along the tree-lined path back there, and in the distance, snow-topped mountains. As I entered the McGarvas' home, I couldn't help but appreciate its beauty and began to imagine what summers there would be like. However, the purpose of our visit quickly brought me back to the tragic reason we were there, to speak with this lovely family about their relative Yogi and the heartbreaking event that occurred in their home nearly 4 years ago. Walking through the kitchen and past the living room, I made my way to the kitchen table where Jerry was seated. I greeted another one of Jerry's adult children, offering them the opportunity to join us, but they indicated that the discussion was primarily for Yogi's brother and sister to share their experience and their fight for justice. I took a seat next to Jerry at the kitchen table while Russell settled at the opposite end. A member of our production crew sat opposite me, and our sound engineer begins to set up the microphones. I had a list of questions to ask, starting with Russell, and I asked if there was anything that he would like to tell us about Yogi. Instantly, we're all reminded about the depth of the pain and the love the family has for Yogi. Russell starts out the interview with a lot of emotion and a lot of love and a lot of good memories. Then Jerry will jump in and we'll have a conversation about the long, arduous journey to get to this point.
My name is Russell McGarva. I'm Yogi's little brother. He was a nice person, a nice human being, and everybody loved him being around. He was a good human being, and he had a lot of respect because he helped everybody. He was always there, you know, for me, for everybody, actually. You know, and he was set on tribal council for a while. A lot of special activities, you know. He was kind of a homebody, but he still got out there because he got so big there for a while. You know, he started staying home, and then we got after him kind of like, you know, if you go on a run, maybe the Creator will make you better. He went on a run, you know, and he got more involved with my nephew, Ricky. That would be Dewey's boy, who passed on, but Ricky was here still, and Yogi helped raise him, you know, and got involved in his little life there for a while. So that helped him out, but, I mean, my brother gave the shirt off your back if you asked him for it. But we grew up in Nevada, and my dad's from here, and we all went to Nevada when we was younger, and my dad retired, and he come back here, and this is where we all kind of gathered up now. And now it's not much to gather, just me and my sister. And I had four other brothers pass on. And I started out with my oldest brother, Quirt. He passed away. Then Casey, my little brother, he passed away. Then I had another little brother named Dewey who passed away, and now it's Yogi. I'm the only boy left of us six kids, and then I have my sister left. You know, it's been real hard on both of us, but I don't know how to deal with it very much. It's real hard. To even be in this house for me, because 5 feet away from me right now is what happened. Yeah. He didn't deserve what happened to him. Nobody does in this world, as far as I'm concerned. And my brother is being treated like he's on trial, or our family's on trial because of the way what happened to him. And that's not right. I don't believe that. The person who done this, allegedly done this, is walking around from the jail to the courthouse, no shackles, no nothing, you know, just like, that. To me, that's a kick in the balls, excuse my English, but because he's just all kicked back, like nothing, he did nothing wrong. I didn't know we were doing an interview and stuff, and I'm glad we are, because then more people can realize what really goes on in the world instead of just being in blind shadows, you know, because it ain't easy, you know, and I know there's been a lot of other people been murdered and missing and dangerous people and all that, but it's out there, and the Native American world, I think, needs to be more in tune to it, because a lot of them just been pushed over, and that's what they would have done if Jerry didn't step up and put the full pedal to the metal, and I appreciate that, Jerry. I thank you very much.
Do you feel like you have any help or a support network? I see your family here. I see beautiful land. I see beautiful mountains and trees. I don't know if that could be any solace.
Our tribe don't even want to help us. We ask him for help to go to a gathering or something that has involved in this, like the, what is it called?
MMIP.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We asked them for gas money. They ain't got time for that. You know, they got bigger and better casinos to run or something, you know, something else to do with their family. If you don't have nobody on council, you're not going to get no help. It's point blank.
Mm-hmm. Thing that disgusts me is this is newspaper clipping of my mom right here, right? They were at Four Corners. This is when the Pit River tribe was getting recognized to be a federal tribe. My mom in that picture is getting acquitted from taking a 2x4 and hitting her FBI right in the head when they had my grandpa. And they were dragging him out, and she ran up there and she hit the FBI 2x4 in the back of the head. And they turned around and arrested her. They all went to jail. And she gets acquitted right here on these charges of hitting that guy. This is my mom right here.
This is your mom in the photo.
Yep. My grandfather was the one going to jail.
Grandfather was the one going to
jail.
They
all went to jail. Grandmother, everybody. To get the Pit River tribe recognized.
Yeah. Yeah.
And our own tribe, when we asked them for money to help us, they refused us. I said, they gave us $300 for gift card, and they said, that's all we can help you with because it's not a domestic violence charge. Murder one is domestic violence to begin with, right? And he's got all these other charges. They didn't read the whole case. They just gave us $300 worth of gift cards for me and Russell, $150 each. I said, this is what my mom fought for. This is what my grandfather went to jail for. Is to get his federal recognized. It's like, what they sacrificed, what they went to jail for, was only worth $300. Go to a summit last weekend in Sacramento. They got a guy down there representing the tribe that went to prison for domestic violence and everything else. And the same guy that beat this woman up, she's looking for her son. Yogi sat on tribal council. And no support for anything, you know? Nothing.
Did you feel... Please, go ahead, Russell.
That's like a slap in the face. You know what I mean? We're supposed to be their people, our people, whatever you want to call it. They don't have no time for stuff like that. You know what I mean? And they only read the first names that are on there. That just stops right there. They don't look into anything. They don't investigate anything. They just, MacGyver's now. It's all right. You know, or any other people that you got to have a connection on council, or you ain't going to get shit from them. You know, I have some issues with them, but I'm not going to bring that up because that's my deal. But it's just like, you know, my brother was good on council. He, you know, did what he's supposed to do. And it's just like, who are them individual people on council? Are they God, or they think they're God? But they need to be set in their place too, as far as I'm concerned. And I wish no bad on them. You know what I mean? But something's got to open their eyes and see our people are suffering. Not just my family. There's other families out there too, you know, that don't know where their son or daughter or mom is. And there's a lot of them like that. But they don't seem to have time for that. You know what I mean?
It makes me sick, is that it'd be the first time we get justice for four brothers we lost, and this is the end, you know?
That's the voice of Jerry. Her and Russell are the only siblings left. She goes on to talk about what local law enforcement would say when their brother Dewey went missing back in 2012.
But when Dewey went missing, called Mother County, he'll be back in a couple days, and nobody would listen to us. We always knew where Dewey was. He should have been home. I felt like I'm a chicken shit because I didn't stand up for the rest of my brothers that got killed. Because they didn't die from natural causes. They died from somebody else taking their lives.
So the McGarvas are expressing to us how they felt nervous and the lack of trust they had in Modoc County in investigating the death of their brother Yogi after having three other siblings who were killed without what the family calls having much justice. Yogi's sister Jerry tells us that Modoc County tried to plea deal Jarrett with second-degree murder. Jerry said she would just keep hearing the DA say that there wasn't enough evidence and that she was repeatedly told that the violent attack on her brother Yogi was a result of a lover's quarrel that had gotten out of hand. But she believed from the beginning that couldn't be true.
Dolly kept telling me, lover's quarrel got it out of hand. But that's not what happened here. It was premeditated. He had the choice to leave this house and not hurt my brother. But Sadie went in to go to the golf club and came out and hit my brother in the head and fractured his skull, cut his fucking jugular. Overkill. Three different knives in his neck, you know? There's nothing about self-defense. There's nothing about a lover's quarrel when you got enough time in this house to go and get three knives and put them in my brother's neck.
Myself and the production crew are sure to ask Jerry if she'd like to stop, take a break, but they do continue on. The microphones seem a chance to share with the world their pain and their love of Yogi. As we keep talking, I hear about some allegations that local police were called to Yogi's house one day before he was murdered. This didn't come out in the trial, and I haven't independently confirmed it. The story is that Yogi might have called local police and asked for them to come get Jarrett out of the house. But, allegedly, they didn't, and the reason was that Jarrett was just too high, that the police didn't want to arrest him and then have to deal with him themselves. Also, throughout my research and speaking with various people, I've been told that Jarrett allegedly admitted to murdering Yogi several times while Jarrett was hospitalized, but that law enforcement that was there never read him his Miranda rights. So even if it was a confession of murder, of which I can't independently confirm, not having read him his Miranda rights can cause a jury never to know the confession happened, just like we didn't hear of it, and the jury in this trial never heard of it. In addition, the family says they were told by various DAs of Modoc County who had the case across time that there just wasn't enough evidence to pursue murder one, and the family expresses their frustration at the idea that the DAs were trying to offer a plea deal for that reason, lack of evidence from a brutal, bloody crime scene.
And it's been a long, hard struggle because last 4 years, went to four different DAs I told him my brother could never defend himself. He walked with a walker. He used that walker to get around. I told him my brother could never defend himself. Never. He couldn't get up and hit somebody back because he couldn't stand. It's proof because of all his medical records. And they didn't even care. They wouldn't even consider that. Finally, Attorney General took over the case. And they're charging that guy with murder one. But it took 4 years of arguing, fighting, frustration. Nobody should have to go through all this. All this pain. Every time I talk about my brother, it's like the day he died again.
So there, Jerry was describing that the Attorney General, Rob Bonta, did take on the case. And the defendant, Jarrett, would go to trial for murder one, as opposed to where the local DA was trying to offer a plea deal. On this day that I'm talking to Jerry, the court case and the trial wasn't over yet. Jerry and Russell and their relatives had more to get through. And still, they sit here with us and our production crew, wanting to talk. Jerry goes on to describe the night that Yogi was murdered. She kept trying to go over to the house that was now a crime scene. She said she kept trying so much that they kept saying they were going to arrest her that night.
I ain't let my brother walk out of that house by himself. I want him to know I'm here with him. And he didn't deserve that.
To be sure that Jerry would be there when they brought her brother out, Jerry waited all night in the cemetery where her dad and her other brothers are buried. And she watched and she waited for when he would be brought out.
I still walked in here. I stood by my brother when he pulled him out of here, body bag.
It's clear to me that Jerry and her family are doing everything they can for Yogi, but also through their speaking out, they're also honoring their other loved ones who were killed previously. They've taken the fight for justice for Yogi all the way to the Attorney General. And they also speak and remember their other loved ones and take the time to have us in their home to talk to us despite such a terrible tragedy and despite the heaviness of what we're talking about. Jerry goes on to talk more about the history of the area.
And it's beginning at the Pit River, you know? Pit River starts right out here in these mountains. At one point, this was used to be called Indian Camp, where this house is right here. There was more Indians that lived in this town than there was white people. But you don't hear nothing about how many Indians they massacred. How many kids they massacred. I mean, my kids are the only ones that are Hamawi that live in this country. And then Yogi. A white man killed him. Been a long 4 years to get him to go to trial on that right now, to this day. They made us feel like that we were pieces of shit, you know? We came from a good family. Our dad raised us good. But the way they made us feel like, just like what they're saying about Yogi, drug addict, and he was gay. That shouldn't matter. He was a human. He deserved better than that. And he fought for his life. He wanted to be here. He went through all of the surgeries, everything else. He wanted to live. But somebody took him from us. It should never happen like that. My brother didn't die for being gay. My brother didn't die from doing drugs. My brother was murdered. Dewey went missing. Nobody's been accounted for that. His pickups ran in a snowbank. My brother Court got his head blown off right on Main Street, Elko County, Nevada. I should have stood up a long time ago. Why did he get shot right there on Main Street? Casey got killed by a drunk driving, and that guy got a wet and reckless for killing my brother. I was like, just because we're Indians, it don't matter. The worst thing is I relive my brother's death. Every time I go to somebody, every time I talk about it, it's like the day he died.
And almost in the same breath, as she is able to speak of all this pain, Jerry is also fiercely proud of who she is, who her family is, and the family connections to the land.
We come from bloodlines way back. My grandmother was born right here on this property. And I'm proud of my grandmother. I'm proud of who I am. I'm still here. I'm an Indian.
We've been speaking with Geraldine McGarva and her brother, Russell McGarva. This was in their home in late February 2024, as Jarrett Blue Rucker was on trial for murder of their brother, Yogi McGarva. When our production crew packed up and the microphones were put away, I was thanking Jerry again, and Jerry said that the reason that she does this and does keep talking and about what happened is because she just doesn't want to see anybody else go through it. As we were leaving, Aurelia and I were talking about the flower beds out front. I noticed that there was a small carved wooden bear out front as well. She said that that bear had been there even before Yogi had lived there. I thought it was pretty appropriate. Though nothing was in the garden bed, she was cleaning them out, and she said she'd hoped to plant sunflowers there in the summer. The sun was still shining brightly as we left. I hope to be back, and I hope to see sunflowers in the garden beds.
The water flows through my soul, speaking clearly now. Stay true to who you are. From fresh springs, carry baskets interwoven memories of the ancestors. We come from the sea, the oceans reflect emotions fluidly.
Thank Russell and Jerry McGarva for taking the time to bring us into your home, sharing your stories about Yogi, but also sharing your hope, allowing us to listen to a small window of the pain that you have been going through and enduring. But also, I'm very grateful that you've been able to share with us the connection that you have to the land and your family, and that we get to see the strength that you have as a family unit, and that we were able to be there for you, even if it was just for a short while. You've been listening to the MMIP Justice Podcast, Episode 1. I'm Sarah Blanco. This podcast highlights the journeys, hopes, and quests for justice that loved ones have despite the tragedy they're dealing with. We don't impose our personal ideas or definitions of justice. The discussions transcend geographical boundaries, highlighting the importance of justice and an end to violence and colonial systems that keep us imprisoned or cause us harm. This can resonate with Indigenous communities globally. In Episode 2, the podcast will delve into the Feather Alert system. It's meant to help find missing Native people fast. We explore its launch, 1 year after it started, and the ongoing challenges faced by loved ones, advocates, and policymakers in its implementation. Tune in to learn more about the pitfalls and the efforts needed to navigate the Feather Alert system effectively next week. Our website is mmipjustice.org, and you can follow us on Facebook at MMIP Justice. MMIP Justice is produced and hosted by Sarah Blanco, the sound engineer and mixer and additional co-producer, Frank Sterling. Our show co-host and advisor is Loyan Redhawk Gelly. This podcast series is produced in collaboration with Indigenous Justice, and we want to thank all the village for their help. First, we thank the McGarvas for their time, spirit, and allowing us on their ancestral lands and in their home. Much of the music was by Audio Pharmacy. Opening song is Lose Your Mind. Thank you to Desiree Harp on the vocals, and also thank you, Theo Sense. And thanks to all the artists and musicians of that song and the following songs by Audio Pharmacy as well, including Be There and the intro to the Sundance Film Festival 2018. The instrumental you're listening to now is by Kalina Lawrence with producer DJ Lute. Don't Count Me Out with lyrics is by Kalina Lawrence featuring Desiree Harp. Additional music throughout the show, also the song Ephemera by Scott Buckley, released under CC by 4.0 www.scottbuckley.com.au. A big thank you to CJ for the website, Miss Patty Designs for logo, and Rosca D, Afro Pomo of The Nest and Snag magazine. The watercolor art on the website has a deep local history, from Movimiento Yaya Teatro Brigade, photo by Yaya Porras, and then with their digital futuristic treatment, revision, transformation on the photo, Ruben Revelis. They are stills from a video excerpt of Phoenix, which stems from the awesome theater work titled Stolen Bodies on Stolen Land that was co-created by Yaya Porras and Morningstar Galley, which was part of the 3GT Investigates program. Voices from Sound Collage also included California Assemblymember Ramos. Those clips were from a public press conference. Additional advisors, Morningstar Galley, Mickey Mays, Kathy Jackson, Kat Petru, Dennis Bernstein, and Gavilan Molina. See you next time.